is Brian Thomas, who is an instructor here at Baylor.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Well, Walter told me that I had to wear a suit today, and it was a dirty trick, apparently. Well, not really. This is a very, very dark slide. I apologize, you can't see it very well. The title of my talk is Microhydro Generation of Electricity, Providing Physical and Spiritual Light in Honduras. And the attempt is to kind of overview some of the things. And that's better, thank you. That we've been doing in the past few years. Some of my co-authors here are a former graduate of our program that with an engineering degree and an MBA, because as Steve indicated, viable financial models are a vital part of making any of these changes last, and also Blaine McCormick from our business school here at Baylor as well. So you may have noticed that short-term mission groups, projects, things like this have a certain popularity with church youth groups and college students, and they often involve a mixture of a service project and an evangelism. And the participants of these group projects are often profoundly affected. These projects, the project side of their work is frequently construction-related, whether it's drilling water wells or building homes or churches or doing a water purification system, something like that. And frequently the local people are left to maintain it. Now, unless sustainability, as Steve defined well, unless that's made a goal, that the impact can be short-term when the participants go home. And I had this picture up here to indicate. See, the truck is going home, and I had to wait to the last sentence for you to understand what that was. But I was particularly fond of this photograph, so I had to work it in somewhere. Now, we've been doing energy projects, and so you may ask, why energy projects and not agriculture projects, and why not water purification or some other thing like that? And the answer is, well, if the community and where we're working doesn't have adequate food supply and water supply, then that's not where we're going to work anyway. We're going to let someone else who has expertise in those areas try to affect them. But if they do have those, then we think energy is very important. Energy can, in particular, electricity, but also maybe a gas source, a source of natural gas is another energy source. These can benefit a community in three ways. And so we're trying to focus on this three-pronged approach to benefit the community monetarily, environmentally, and socially. So monetarily, if a business structure is put in place to try to implement such energy projects, then that potentially could be a source of profits to investors. It could also be a source of income to the local villagers. In particular, our system of small electricity companies has the ability to benefit both the local, let's see, what you call the indigenous entrepreneur in the village, and also the villagers who are not necessarily part of the business, but who are economically blessed by the benefits of, say, having electricity. What type of benefits? Well, it could be the ability to earn income. And so this woman here in the village, Danta Uno, Honduras, is posed with her sewing machine for me, and she wanted to know if she could use this sewing machine, which she owned, to have a dressmaking business. And we thought certainly we could. It was so old we couldn't find a sticker on it to find out exactly how much power it drew, but we think that it's probably within the limits of our system. So her intention is to begin a dressmaking business, which she'd actually done before when she lived in another community with electricity. So the ability to spawn other entrepreneurial activities that use electricity is a significant money-making opportunity for a lot of the individuals. There's also the possibility, I'm going to camp out on this slide for just a little bit because it really captures a lot of what we're doing. The ability to benefit a community environmentally, from what the work we're doing in Honduras, at least, we have two possibilities. We want to eliminate the use of kerosene-burning lanterns, or in Spanish they call them a candil, C-A-N-D-I-L. And these are fossil fuel-burning devices that are very inefficient with their energy usage. Therefore, there's a lot of soot that the people breathe. In addition to that, it has other problems associated with fossil fuels and price volatility that's associated with fossil fuels. And beyond that, another source of energy for these people is flashlight batteries. They go to the local store, maybe a mile walk away or so, and they buy diesel alkaline flashlight batteries. Now, much of their culture is biodegradable culture, I will call it. And what that means is that when they're cooking something, the scraps, the banana peels, any of their byproducts are typically biodegradable, and so they throw them out behind the house in the field. Well, they have this mentality, so they do the same thing with their batteries. So used alkaline batteries also get thrown out. We see them everywhere while we're there. So I don't have any evidence to show that these are contaminating the local water table or anything like that, but my suspicion is if we can clean those up, that that's an environmental benefit of some type. Now, socially, there's and even perhaps this is where our strongest benefit is of bringing in electricity. There's a book that's influenced us by an organization formerly called the Intermediate Technology Development Group, ITDG, which is now called Practical Action. And among other things, they have a library and they publish a lot of books on development around the world. And this one is called Electricity Services in Remote Rural Communities, the Small Enterprise Model. So the idea is to generate a small enterprise that supports the electricity. And so this has been a very influential book on our thinking. There's a quote from it. It says, it's widely recognized that electricity is a central element for social economic development. It contributes to economic growth and underpins a range of welfare services such as clean water, health, communication, and education. Research on electrification suggests that rural people only need small amounts of energy to improve their quality of life and their income. In most cases, electricity is necessary for the provision of lighting and community services such as education and health. And then further, if you'll give me for reading quotes to you here, but I have another quote from the World Bank that says, the precise linkages between the infrastructure and development are still open to debate. Now, electricity services, of course, would be a type of infrastructure. So the linkages between that infrastructure development and the development of the community are still open to debate. However, infrastructure capacity grows step for step with economic output. A 1% increase in the stock of infrastructure is associated with a 1% increase in gross domestic product across all countries. So for every bit of investment we put in to their local microscopic economy, we can expect to see commensurate returns, I believe, in their local economy. So, we had a few earlier attempts at energy projects that had, I wouldn't say they were failures, but I wouldn't say they were doing everything that we would like them to do. In 2006, we traveled to Nairobi, Kenya, and put in a wind and solar hybrid system that used wind power and solar power to generate small amounts of electricity for local people living in a slum there in Nairobi. And we had great partners with this, and we had high hopes. We had a partner with Nairobi University, with this organization, Intermediate Technology Development Group, who has an office in Nairobi, and a community group there in the local community. And so we thought surely between the three of them and that they would be able to keep things running. And we decided that the community group was going to be the owner of the system and it would be maintained and supported with the help of these other groups. But what we've kind of come to believe now is that community-owned means nobody owns. And when the system had problems, there was arguments over whether or not they should spend the community money to make the repairs, because not everyone in the community was being served by it. And so there became this social argument about the appropriate allocation of funds. And consequently, the system went too long without repair and is now operating at probably 10 to 15% of its capacity. Now, it is still operating, and if you may recall, back in December of 2008, there were the Kenyan riots resulted in, or the Kenyan election resulted in a lot of riots, and much of the slum that we were serving was torn down. However, torn down in the rioting, but our system was still in place because it was held in a public latrine, and my contact told me that it doesn't matter what tribe you're from, you still have to go to the bathroom. So the latrine was held in place. And so, but since then, we've come to view that this idea of a community-owned system is really somewhat of a socialist idea. And you know, being good capitalists, we decided maybe a more capitalist approach would be a better idea. And so in 2007, we went down to Honduras and put in a small hydro system. That's a micro hydroelectric, means just like Hoover Dam, but in 1/1,000,000th of the power level. So small rivers that run generators to produce electricity. And so we generate electricity for a village church and a battery recharging station. And we knew that this had to be a functional business. So we told them, hey, you guys need to run a functional business. And this is what you should charge. And see you later. And it turns out that wasn't enough business training to make it sustainable. So they did continue to charge cell phone. They charged cell phones for 5 lempiras, which is about 3 cents or something. And so there was a little bit of a business, but we have no idea how many they do. They don't keep any records or anything. And electricity at the church is still functioning. The house next to the church asked permission, hey, can we please wire into your electricity? They said, sure. So they ran a couple of wires from extension cords over to the house that was next to the church. But they didn't get it quite right. And it turns out that now you have to have the lights on at the church in order for the house to have electricity, because they wired them in series instead of parallel. Anyway, that was somewhat amusing to me. But so our thought has been to have an ongoing transition towards a more focus on the business model. And our ideas have been influenced by this book, although I can't say that I've actually read it. But I've had so many people that I've had discussions with that's influenced their thinking, and therefore it's influenced mine. And that is to begin to see the poor as customers. And then, Steve, you mentioned that Mr. Grameen, what's his name? No, not Muhammad Yunus, the one the Nobel Prize for the Grameen Bank, microloans. He's also sort of the Grameen phone company, where he lets the women from rural villages buy credit and borrow the phone, or they lease the phone. I'm not sure how it works, and they go into rural communities, and if you need to make a phone call, it's a mobile pay phone, essentially. So you can pay the service and make the call. There's other organizations, Paul Pollock and Martin Fisher, doing designs for the poor with a technology-enabled, entrepreneurial-based type of development like this. So we thought, well, what is our unmet demand, okay? Our unmet demand is, we defined this to be the approximately 1.6 billion people on the planet that don't have access to electricity in their homes. And this is a photograph of Waldina. Waldina lives in Danta Uno, Honduras. And when I took this photograph in 2008, she was pregnant and she was cooking plantains for dinner. And she was using this light source right here, which is called a candile. And it's a homemade kerosene-burning lantern. And it's a glass bottle filled with kerosene and a little wick that comes up the top that's lit. And the kerosene wicks up the cloth and is burned. And so this is essentially like a Molotov cocktail that a rioter would throw, although they would probably use gasoline instead of kerosene. But you can see that it's an obvious fire hazard. And if it falls on the floor, then you have a fire. There's an absence of emergency services there, so that could be a very life-threatening device. So why is this met? Why is this demand unmet? This 1.6 billion people without electricity, and we believe that it's the centralized production of electricity combined with the decentralized nature of the rural population that it just makes it financially prohibitive to reach these people. They can't do some of the key functions that are required for an electricity provider. That is to deliver the power and then to read meters, collect the payments, and prevent theft. Some of the problem is these people don't even have addresses. They're just out there in such and such village. There's no way, there's no mailbox, there's no mail system. How do you bill them? And so you either have a prepaid system or you have some other mechanism, and that's what we've decided to use. So these four things we've addressed in our model. Also, the average amount of energy that's used by a particular rural customer in these countries is typically very low, and therefore that compounds the problem of it not being economical for the deliverers. So our solution was to form an energy company that is a franchisor of small energy companies. So we formed a company, we gave it the name Village Energy, and this is a franchisor, like corporate McDonald's that's making franchises. And what we do is we start franchises in local villages. This would be a micro enterprise, and we would help them deploy their system, help them get it functional, give them a business in a box is what we have, is the idea we're after. That aspect of franchising is directly applicable. If you're going to start a McDonald's, then why would you want to do that? Well, you have an existing set of plans, menus, all the practical day-to-day decisions have been made for you. And then, in that sense, it's a business in a box. In addition to that, in the United States, you have the advantage of having corporate McDonald's do your advertising for you. Now, we don't have that aspect, but the business in a box aspect of our project is very applicable. So the people here in the villages, homes and small businesses, will receive electricity, and in turn for that, they will make utility payments. And then the franchise itself receives support from the franchisor, technical support and business support, and then they pay franchise fees and income fees. And then we use low interest loans from lenders or other sources such as the World Bank that will give these franchises the $12,000 to $15,000 per village that they need for capital. That will be paid off by the franchise itself. And after the time it's paid off, then the franchise fees increase to the franchisor. Investors then, private investors, would be to support the franchisee. And then we also have on here carbon markets. Renewable energy, the generation of renewable energy, such as hydropower or others, will earn credits that can be sold on the carbon markets of Europe, for instance. And so once we reach a certain critical mass, we may be able to sell those. It's probably not economically viable to do until we have 20 or 30 villages at least, because the amount of money it would cost just to process the paperwork would consume the profits. So looking at it from this business point of view, the customer profile looks like this. An agricultural worker, this is our typical customer. He lives in a village of 50 to 500 people. He grows his own food on rented plots. Landowners, one person in six in the village is a landowner. Typically, the other people grow their own food on their lots and then work for the landowners in larger fields. They make $4 to $5 per day, and their energy costs are, according to our surveys, $7.44. And this comes from three sources. This is buying kerosene for kerosene lanterns. This is using batteries for flashlights, and it's for charging cell phones. So those three things, those three energy costs can be, we use those as our pricing target. $7.44 a month is just above our entry level version. So you can have our entry level electricity package for slightly less than that, and then it goes up to several prices that are higher for more sophisticated users, or more wealthy users anyway. So this is a photograph of one of our hydro systems. This is some students from this summer posing for the picture. Over here, there's a dam. This is in a riverbed here. You can see these boulders are in the riverbed. The water comes flowing down the large pipe here at a rate of 63 liters per second. It reaches this point here. There's a box with a generator inside. It falls down approximately 10 feet, and as it gives up that energy, that energy is converted into electricity, which is then brought out on a power line, approximately 770 watts, at 48 volts DC. Now, 48 volts DC is not very useful for appliances, so what we do is we take that 48 volt DC over to a powerhouse that's on the shore. And this is the outside of the powerhouse, and this is the inside. And inside, we have a battery bank, which stores energy during the day or during the night. So, both day and night, actually. And so that the peak times around evening we'll be able to supply that. Then we have some electronic equipment to an inverter to make standard 120 volt AC, like you would find in an outlet. We have some circuit breakers to protect the trunks and a dump load controller. We had a lightning strike from a severe storm and blew out some of our electronics, and that was it took us a while to overcome that problem. Also, I'd like to mention this. You see, we've painted our powerhouse bright yellow and have our giant logo. See, the logo is EPA, not the Environmental Protection Agency, but Energía para Aldeas, which means energy for villages. And there's a little lightning bolt in there. I think it's very cool. And it's you see the color branding. This is something that Dr. McCormick, one of our business associates, helped us understand what color branding was. As we were driving around Honduras, we would see building after building that painted all one color. For instance, the cellular phone company named Tigo had a bright blue building with a white logo on it. You see the same color building after building. Blaine, our business associate, said, hey, you know what, that they're doing color branding. What they're doing is every time you see that color, it's associated with that company, and you know what it is before you can even read the logo. But when it's still way up on the horizon, you see that color, and you know what it is. We need a color, and we'll paint all our buildings this, and then every time someone sees this color, they'll think of us. And so we decided that electricity, of course, is yellow. And so yellow became our good color, and then we painted a red on there. And we found out later that the police also use yellow for their... But anyway, well, hopefully that's not going to be a problem. Yeah, maybe they will. So once the power leaves the powerhouse, it goes to individual homes. We have a little electronically resetting circuit breaker at each home. So one circuit breaker protects the entire home. And if you use too much power, then the circuit breaker turns off for 15 seconds and all your lights go out, and then it turns back on. And if you've unplugged a few appliances, then you'll be in good shape and it'll stay on. But if you continue to use more than your allotted power level, it'll keep turning off every 15 seconds. Another interesting aspect of our distribution system was that we used trees. There's a tree in Honduras that's used for barbed wire fences. It's called the madreado tree. And it has long, straight branches. And these long branches can be cut off of the tree. It doesn't hurt the tree. The tree continues to grow. And then you plant the branch in the ground, and lo and behold, it will turn into a new madreado tree. And so they're a very vigorous tree. And so we decided, instead of cutting down trees, and it turns out power poles are the main cost of distributing power in the United States, the main cost, and more so than the lines, it's the poles, rather. So this is a major savings for us. We have the locals go out and cut down our poles and put them up, or we'll use other living trees themselves. Now, in the United States, you wouldn't do this because you would have all kinds of interference from branches and animals and everything else. But because the people that own the system live locally and they walk these lines every day, usually with machete in hand, their job is to maintain the lines by cutting off extra growth that comes up around the lines, and they keep it trimmed. So in the United States, we value automation, but there we have an abundant source of labor, and therefore we're going to try to maintain these with continual upkeep in a way that's very appropriate for their culture, because they're doing these things all the time. Stan, how are we doing on time?
We have 5 minutes.
Okay. So Our business model also, we're using a so-called BOOT franchise model. And the BOOT stands for build, own, operate, and transfer. So we build it, we own it, they operate it, and eventually we transfer a portion of the ownership to them. So this is micro-franchise plus rent-to-own. And these are a couple of our guys that are our owners. This is Walter and Adolfo, and they are putting out power lines here. And this solves the problems that the large utilities can't do. Because the large utilities can't deliver power, read meters, prevent theft, these guys, these employee owners, they live in the village itself. And therefore, maintenance, like I mentioned, walking the lines with a machete, is not a problem. They don't have to send somebody out from this city. They're walking that line to every day when they bring their cows from one pasture to another. Billing and collection, we've gone to a flat rate system. So there's no meters to read. Everyone pays a fixed rate every month, which is helpful for budgeting. And theft prevention is also prevented by these people walking the lines all the time. Because I don't know if you understand how electricity is stolen in developing countries, but it's typically people climb the poles and they make illegal taps. They tap into the wires and then they bring power off that bypasses any meter or limiting system, and therefore they can use as much power as they want if they're willing to risk their lives to make these illegal connections when the power's on. So theft prevention is easily solved by having our inspectors be there every day, essentially. Okay. Now, our employee owner, not our customer profile, but our employee owner profile, we want to find people in the village that have certain skills. They need to be literate, and that is not a given. Many of the people are not literate there. And they need to be intelligent, problem solvers, peacemakers. They need to be able to disconnect for non-payment and not be afraid of that. And so in our last time, we had somebody that still they were behind on their bill, and it was going to be the first disconnect. And so one of our other partners, Ryan, our former student, he was down there, and he got them all psyched up and said, we've got to make an example here of someone who's not going to, if they're not going to pay their bill, they're going to have to get disconnected. And he was able to get the employee owners to the state where they actually hoped the guy wouldn't pay so they could disconnect him just to make a point. So we also give them training, technical training in electricity, which they know nothing about. Some of our students this summer taught some older women who lived in the village how to plug something in. They had a cell phone, but they always paid someone else to charge it, so they just brought the cell phone and the charger and had them do it. They didn't know how to plug anything in. And so we got the opportunity, the privilege, really, of teaching them how to plug something in. We also give the owners training, both in the technical and operations, and in entrepreneurial training for the generation of new businesses. Because remember what I said, this electricity is going to be effective in combating poverty more so when we can start other follow-up businesses. And so here, Blaine is teaching a couple of the guys some basic business principles. And you can't see it, but there's a Coca-Cola right down here. And he was using that as an example of doing a balance sheet, really. Well, how much water do you think Coca-Cola puts in? How much do you think it costs to make the plastic bottle? And how much sugar and how much other product and advertising and delivering? And then how much they sell it for? And then here's the difference. That's the profit. And so just some basic ideas like this, which these people intuitively understand. These two guys, third grade and sixth grade education here, are our entrepreneurial representatives. But this one has already started a business selling goods from his home, a little small store. And this fellow has a fish farm. Okay. So just to show you what type of, how much power we can produce 2,310 lux hours of light per dollar. That doesn't compare very well to a U.S. utility, which can provide 19,200 lux hours per dollar. So we're a much more expensive system than a U.S. utility. But however, U.S. utility is not an option for these people. What is kerosene lanterns and batteries, which we have between 25 and 100 something times as much light per dollar. So in that sense, we have a just system, I believe. Here is a before and after photograph of Waldina. This is 2008, 2009, with and without her lighting system. We give support to the church in the sense of half-price electric bills. We distribute some biblical literature with the light. And then also, it's been a nice experience for our students. Forgive me for reading this quote. This is from one of our students. My experiences in Honduras have had a huge impact on my life. In a way, it was thrilling to know that something was going to be built based on the calculations I performed. As an added bonus, I had the satisfaction of knowing that the project would change the lives of people that I met and was while I was there. I discovered that using the same engineering skills that I'd gotten so tired of at the library could be incredibly rewarding. I like that. So in summary there, we have come up with a for-profit model that we believe is superior to a community-owned model. We have formed Village Energy Incorporated to franchise these small businesses. We've done two villages so far. We don't consider ourselves fully ready to franchise yet. I think we need to do another half dozen, maybe 10 more villages before we get all our bugs worked out. I don't mean to imply that we're there yet. And we view this company as a triple bottom line values, both people, planet, and the profit itself. So that's all I have. If there's any questions, I'll be happy to take those. Otherwise, I'll turn it over to the next guy. Okay. Yes, ma'am. Drop the ball on our system in Kenya was operating a medical clinic.